All right, we are here. We are Galexis, and welcome.
Welcome to you too.
Thank you. It's good to be here and bright spirits assembled. Today we talk about healing relationships. About healing relationships that have gone dysfunctional, who have been wounded, that have suffered in the past. But also about creating healing relationships. Relationships that by building them or creating them and then building them, you'll be able to continuously heal yourself on a day-to-day basis. Two usages of the terms healing relationships. Both valuable, both useful. Part of the same process. You see, when you came to the physical plane to discover and to explore the earth and the physical plane reality, and with your missions and purposes in hand, you had to forget who you were. It was part of the necessary rules of the game, so to speak. And you voluntarily chose to forget who you were. In case you don't remember, who you are, or in who you were, was a radiant, extraordinarily huge light being who knew that he or she was a spark of the divine, was a piece of the body of God, God is all that is, was a glorious, powerful, radiant light being on a mission. Knowing your own divinity, of course, you were able to plug into and experience as part of your essential nature an extraordinary level of love, extraordinary level of peace and safety. Phenomenal experience that is natural and normal for a divine being. Your relationship with God, God is all that is, beautiful, close, intimate, being part of the oneness, to be able to love all things, to be able to understand and to know who you were and are on many dimensions, to know all the lifetimes and all the experiences that you've had on this planets and other star systems, galaxies, and even universes. To know the wholeness and the totality of the many aspects and infinite aspects of yourself. And when you are in that state of conscious awareness, consciously aware of who you are, your relationships have no separation between them. There is a distinction because you chose to experience individuality while still maintaining connection with the divine. So when you meet someone on the other side in that place of your knowing, they who also know who they are and you will connect and become one. And experience divine union. And in this union, you can learn everything about each other. And experience a sense of ecstatic transcendence. Where you can lift beyond even the awareness of your own greatness to the awareness of the multiple greatness. And you have enjoyed playing in that way, enjoying experiencing this divine love where there is no pain, no suffering, and no separation. But when you were given the opportunity to come here to Earth to participate in a great consciousness revolution, you said, that sounds like fun. Count me in. I want to be part of that. So you chose to enter physical plane reality. And one of the things you wanted to do here was to create from scratch. You wanted to learn how to create in an illusion. An illusion, a matrix of light and mirrors. You know, like a magician in a show. You created that here. Reflections, lights, played with it in such a way to make it feel substantive, gave it three dimensions, so that it has a semblance of depth and reality. And so in order for you to play with this stuff, in order for you to create from scratch, with total free reign of imagination, it required that you forget your greatness. It required that you forget the oneness. So you as an individual could learn to create as an individual spark. An individual spark of the body of God. God is all that is. And as that individual spark, part of your personal mission on this planet, through however many lifetimes it takes you, and what types of adventures that you go on, the object is to develop this spark of light that you are to the greatest extent that you can, so that you can truly own and remember your divine self. And when you get really, really good at having a fabulous time, dancing in the light, enjoying your creative activities and creating realities with this illusion stuff, then your choice is you will graduate, so to speak, into your global work, where you participate in one form or another, whether passively, aggressively, actively, through observation and sending it on as a messenger or bringing information in, that you are participating in this wonderful consciousness revolution. And when you get to enjoy that, when you get to create a transformational consciousness shift of everyone on this planet, or to participate in it with others, other sparks like yourself, to where you can experience the oneness together, and that they can experience their divine self as well as you, then there no longer needs to be the illusion. And then you graduate, so to speak, to playing with stuff that's more real, more substance of the divine, to create other realities, perhaps much more profound, maybe your own planets, galaxies, or universes, maybe your own people and races that you put upon your planets, your animals and plants that you create there. But what you came to, this particular earth, is a model of creativity. Because if you were to compare the number of species on this particular planet with the number of species on virtually any other planet in your universe that supports life, you will find, to your amazement, that this has one of the most incredible variety of species. It's as if God, Goddess, all that is, and you together in your creation of this illusion had an imagination grown wild. You're able to imagine thousands and millions of unique forms through which to manifest. So of course, when you came down here into this lower or limiting dimensional construct, you who were comfortable in 49 dimensions, shrank yourself kind of into within four, and brought up only a piece of you in, because the great self that you are cannot all fit into a measly four dimensions. When you came into this 3D world, surrounded and bordered by time space, or the fourth dimension, you decided that you were going to experience it all. You were going to explore as far as you could go from God, Goddess, all that is. You're going to stretch your imagination to go as far to touch the furthest boundaries, conceptually speaking, of forgetting who you are. And you know, when you thought about coming down here, you thought this was going to be easy. You said, oh, that looks like fun. There's no problem. I have no problem with that. That won't be an issue at all. Oh, this will be a breeze. This will be fun. And then you came down into this limiting place and forgot who you were. And in your forgetfulness, got caught up in the illusion. And so the relationships that you looked for to experience, you could not have divine union, because that required that you knew who you were and that they knew who they were, and that you both recognized your divinity. So the level of love that you were used to suddenly was not seemingly available. And also because you decided to take yourself as far away from the experience of being divine, just to find where that point of turnaround was, to stretch the outer boundaries of possibility, you encountered a place in where you actually denied your divinity. You entered a place we call shame, a place of feeling flawed, undeserving, unworthy, a place of feeling not okay, not good enough, a place of darkness and of pain. And because this was your free will to experience this, there was no intervention made up on your behalf, because it was your choice to explore it to its furthest degree. And once you touched that point, you could turn around, move more now into the remembrance of who you are, into the memory of your divine nature, and return to the acknowledgement of your divine self, and then build by your creative juices in your imagination a reality for yourself to play in, a playground for yourself to explore, to create. So one of your very most natural drives is to create. Another natural drive, which is what we speak about today, is to have relationships, to seek the love, to find the connection to the divine. And once you hit the shame, initially, you tend to think that that connection to the divine must be outside you. Indeed, when you come in as an infant, as a baby, you rely upon your mother to survive. You would not survive if she did not give you milk, either her own or formula or whatever. You wouldn't survive if you had not been held, if you had not been kept warm and fed. You would not have made it if you had not received enough love from her. And of course, because at first, it took you a while to figure out that you were a separate being, because you had come from the oneness, you still thought you and mother were one and the same. But when you began to separate your awareness and see the distinction between you and your mother, and you realized, oh my gosh, I am an individual. I have a separate form. And there's this mother. And when the first concept of or concern that your mother might withdraw her love from you, it was terrifying. The fear of abandonment that comes in childhood. And thus began your dance of relationship, always seeking the divine. And by its very nature, as you seek the divine, any relationship you seek to connect in, to establish, to link with, from the get-go, has always been searching for some reflection of the divine. As we say, this reality, an illusion, constructed with light and mirrors. Everything that you see here, reflections in one form or one level or another, to give you the messages, to remind you of who you are, always. So as you seek the love, you also get the reflections of who you are that's doing the seeking. But you were not aware of that as a child. When you were a child, you discovered soon enough that you were powerless. You were dependent. There was somebody else, a God, God in person form, somehow an authority, that determined your life. Your mother, your father, maybe older siblings, maybe parental relatives, adults that were in your venue. And as you got older and went to school, there were teachers and other authority figures. And as you got older into adolescence, then you gave authority to the popular kids. You gave authority to society. You began that transfer of authority to government, to police, to institutions, to law. But all through all of that, you were seeking the love, always seeking. There are several forms in which you sought love. Anytime you got attention as a child, you felt it as some kind of form of love. Didn't matter what kind of attention it was. But it was the closest representation of love. It was like someone is seeing me. Someone is paying attention to me. Therefore, there's something they're seeing. There's something that's resonating between us. There's a light there. They wouldn't be doing it if there wasn't something here inside me. Attention, approval, praise. These are things the child lives for. And if the child doesn't get enough attention in a positive way, they will act up and get attention in a negative way. But attention they must have in one way or another, unless or until the child admits their shame, admits that they are unworthy to be loved, admits that somehow or another that they are some kind of dark mistake of God. Those who are abused, those children who are abused go there and they hide their pain. They withdraw in their pain. They try to cope the best they can. You may have been one who had to learn how to cope the best you could. How did you cope? Perhaps with fantasy. Perhaps you visited friends on the other side who kind of said, don't give up hope. Something's ahead. Don't live. Come on. You can stay here. Somehow visions. Somehow you thought if I just, you know, did the right behavior, I would survive. And if I survive long enough, I'll find the love. Needy you were. Dependent. Seeking the love. As you went into adolescence, then, of course, this needingness got transferred to your peer group and their approval and their attention and their love. And you either played into the rules of the peer group to try and please the top dogs, to, in a sense, see how high you can get your pecking order or how high your ranking, how high your status, some of which you felt was given to you, in a sense, by your appearance. Perhaps if you had enough money, you could have good clothes to show off, something that would give you approval by your peer group. And if you didn't have good social skills, or you kept putting your foot in your mouth and embarrassing yourself, you might have taken the opposite tact and been the rebel. You might have withdrawn to the fridge. Or you might have rebelled directly. I'm going to get attention by acting up. I'm going to aggravate people. That's the way it is. And they will give me attention. Always looking for that approval, that validation, that you are okay, that you're good enough, that you're not some kind of dark mistake of God. But the potential humiliation, the potential shunning, a potential rejection was so painful. You manipulated yourself. You put a facade upon. You became duplicitous in yourself. There was the real you that you attempted to keep hidden so you would not be vulnerable to attack. And the facade you that you presented in social situations. So you learned how to play the games. You learned politics. Even if you look at your presidential politics, even as you look at politics around the world, between countries, it's all adolescent. It's all high school revisited. The same dynamics, jockeying for position, for approval. The ones who can control and be the authorities, the others who try to seek the approval and the attention of the authorities, of the ones that are the leaders, or try to be up there with the leaders, or try to rebel against the leaders, or try to be on the fringe and withdraw and not participate. So you learned politics as an adolescent. And you use that politics in your relationships, because it was in adolescence that the whole fantasy about love, as you were seeking love, of course, the whole fantasy about love was given to you in a social cultural context. It was given to you by the movies, by TV, by media, by urban legends. It was given to you by your friends, books, images of what a perfect relationship would be. And of course, as you were besmitten with all your hormones, lots of passion, lots of intensity, these images became very, very powerful, dominating images in your psyche. You kept looking for that love. You kept looking for that perfection in a relationship. And what mythologies were you given? Was it Cinderella and the prince? Cinderella, oh, one day I'll be taken away. I'll be lifted in rapture by the one who loves me and taken to this wonderful place, protected, nurtured, and taken care of. And I won't have to suffer any longer. Or perhaps the prince role. Oh, one day I will find this wonderful person. And she and I will settle down and have children, and it will show who I am. It will be part of my status. It will be part of the approval. I will grow up and people will admire me and respect me. They'll respect my virility. They'll respect my power. I will show them I can support this. I can have this beautiful woman on my arm. Arm candy, you call it. The ideal, the beautiful man and woman. Needless to say, it didn't match everybody. Because it's in adolescence that a person looks in the mirror and goes, oh my gosh, my nose is too big, my ears are too whatever, I've got zits, my hair is a wreck. How could I possibly get love if I'm not perfect? The shame of it, the hiding of the shame, then became paramount. Paramount for every one of you to hide the shame. For men to hide their feelings of inadequacy. for women to hide what they thought were their ugliness or their lack of what to give, their lack of value. Women beginning to earn, trying to earn love, trying to give value and attention, and oh, if I build the guy up, then he will love me. If I support him emotionally, he will love me. And the guy, oh gosh, if I can find the right woman, I won't have to deal with my inadequacy. She will save me. It'll be obvious. There'll be someone under me in the pecking order. I won't be the bottom. I won't be the outcast. I won't be the dregs of society. I'll have a woman under me. I'll show that I am something. And I won't have to reveal my shame. I can hide it. The dance continued into young adulthood, late teens into the 20s, where for most people, the fantasy ideal was to settle and nest and have a family or to become successful in business and therefore attract good mates, to do something that will attract the right mate, to secure that future, to secure that perfect relationship, to secure the vision and the fantasy of love, getting that love. And it's, in a sense, good that time and hormones will naturally throw you into young adulthood, because otherwise the dark side of adolescence would continue. The dark side of adolescence being the mythology, let's say, of Romeo and Juliet, the ultimate longing of separated star-crossed lovers who prefer death to being separate. How strong must their love have been, so to speak? So you thought, maybe I could find that Romeo or Juliet. Maybe I could find that other person. Maybe I could settle down there. And when I get there, then maybe I will get the respect from my parents, the love from my parents that I never got. Maybe I'll have children who will love me. They need me. They're dependent on me. They'll have to love me. I'll finally get love. And when I get old and tossed aside, they'll take care of me. I won't be abandoned. I won't be lonely. All the thinking that goes on, given to you by your culture, which you either accepted or you rebelled against. But nevertheless, whether you accepted it or rebelled against it, you are still doing the dance with it. You are still stuck within the confines of what was possible, what was allowable, what was going on in this 3D world bordered by time and space. But you soon found, as you went into what you were thinking were going to be mature relationships, that you weren't all that mature. There are several factors that you were looking for that would tell you, this is the one, this is it. Men would say, okay, I feel a lot of love and excitement and passion, but is this the best I can do? Should I try for somebody better? The woman thinking, all right, well, is he going to earn good money to support the children? Looking at each other very carefully to see, is this going to fit the ideal? Am I going to get what I want? And if I could set this up, maybe then the rest of my life can be more successful. Maybe there can come a point where I can actually be myself. Once I get this security set up, I can be myself then. Maybe I can spend more attention on myself. Maybe I can express my creativity. Maybe I can learn something. Maybe I can grow. But I got to get this set up first, or I got to get my money so that when I'm abandoned, I'm not going to end up in a trash heap. I'm going to be able to support myself and live well. And then I could attract maybe really good mates because, by golly, I've got money. I've got some control. I've got some resources. Or maybe I'm just really, really a good person and I have so much to offer a relationship, I'll sacrifice myself to the person. They won't know how lucky they are. I'll serve them. I'll give them everything. I'll make them feel happy. I'll give them the perfect relationship. And in turn, maybe they'll give me that. Now, there are several factors that come into play here. Because as you initiated your relationships, you discovered that some of them were marked by incredible intensity of emotion. Some of you said, oh my gosh, this is the marker. This is it. I've fallen in love. This is amazing. This is really intense. This is fantastic. This must be it. This must be the perfect relationship. It's so Romeo and Juliet. It's so perfect. It's so wonderful. But underneath it all, there are agendas looking for love. One of the agendas you bring with you as part of a divine being's program is that every relationship that you encounter, whether it's a family relationship, a child, like a parent-child or child relationship or a loved one, a lover or a good friend, every relationship that you come into is marked by the need to find the love there. And whatever it takes, you will do. Whatever strategies you learned as a child, whatever strategies you learned as an adolescent, whatever strategies you learned as a young adult, you'll use whatever you can to secure a good relationship or what you think is a good relationship. So when you enter a relationship, you have this initial honeymoon period. And that's not just for lovers. It can be for friends. It can be, you know, new people that you meet, potential business partners even. And so if you may think this is meant to be because of that. But the agendas underneath there are going to reflect to you what you need to clear, what could stand in your way. So you will attract to yourself people with issues that dovetail with your issues. It's magical how it happens. That perfect relationship may be somebody who can push your buttons better than anybody else. And whose buttons you can push, you can get them ticked off better than anybody. You know their weak spots almost from the get-go and vice versa. So your initial relationships explore, and this can happen with friendships and adolescents as well. We'll explore the dynamics of relating very clearly. But you don't have the power and the knowledge and the wisdom so much when you're an adolescent or young adult or whatever to be able to take this mirroring image and to process it. So there are several stages that a relationship goes into. The first stage, the honeymoon stage, is where, oh, it's all discovery and it's all great and it's all fun. Don't we have fun together? Isn't it great? And we talk about our past and we hear about things and we present, you know, such a beautiful side to each other. And then as it gets deeper, there's more opening and more experience, more intimacy, more connection. You learn more about the person. And here's where you begin to get the first hints of the reflections of your stuff, of your agendas. And as they first come up, it may be that person says, okay, I'll see you Thursday night at 7, and they don't show up, or they're not there when you arrive. And that's funny. That feels very strange. They're not here for me. They said they would be here and they're not here. That's uncomfortable. That's weird. Oh, okay. It's probably nothing. I'll dismiss it. So little things that come up, little maybe lies, little games, little this, little that, little controls, little manipulations. And you'll discount them. Oh, okay. That's not that much. And you put on good behavior. or they put on good behavior to you. So you think that you're seeing this absolutely wondrous, self-realized person. But good behavior lasts only so long. Good behavior, a good strategy from childhood, putting on the facade, a good strategy from adolescence. But from an adult, mature point of view, it accelerates the awakening of your issues. Why? Because every relationship you get into seeks to move deeper towards the realization of love and God, God is all that is, and the realization of your divinity. Relationships are not stagnant. They don't ever stay at one place. They always are attempting to move forward. And you can resist and pull them backward and break them down and in a sense, destroy them. But your purpose, what you seek, is more light, more love. So inevitably, a relationship of any significance will move deeper into greater significance and into greater meaning. And then you will have what is known as the intimacy crisis. If you'll think back on all the relationships you've had, you'll recognize that there was a point at which all of a sudden the issues came to the surface, kabang, and it generally comes in the form, let's say, of an argument, a disagreement, a sense of order or a point of order that is argued, a sense of your vision and their vision and your ideas, their ideas, your ideals and hopes and dreams and their ideals and hopes and dreams coming into some kind of conflict. Where they don't stack up, or from their point of view, you don't stack up. And there's an argument, there's a disagreement, there's tension, there's stress. And you feel the first pain of separation. Hopefully, you can talk it through and make it up. But generally what happens here, in a relationship with a friend or a lover or business partner potentially or whatever, when you reach this point, that's when both of you, out of fear, pull back, create separation, create distance, and reexamine. Oh my gosh, this does not feel safe. I will have to tiptoe forward on this one. And in order for me to feel safe enough to tiptoe forward on this one, there's got to be some conditions. Got to be some rules, or there's got to be some kind of order. We've got to figure out how we do this so that we can both function safely and we can feel okay about it. So you go into your grab bag of tricks. Some people go into their childhood grab bag. I will try to please. I will shut down and be submissive and I'll be quiet. Or I will act out and have a temper tantrum. Something. I'll do a childhood strategy and see what that does. Because I know that when I had a temper tantrum and if I really pulled a really good one, I could get my way. My parents would get worn out from it and they'd say, okay, all right, okay. Okay, you can sleep over at your friend's house or whatever. You can go to that movie. You can go to the concert, whatever. Yeah, I'll try that one again. So you'll pull up your strategy. They'll pull up their strategy. You'll do a little dance, figuring out, okay, what patterns shall we do here? What works here? Or maybe you'll grab bag something from adolescence. Where maybe you'll use ridicule or hostility or some kind of threat of leaving. I'll threaten the other person with loneliness, with separation. Or they will threaten you. Oh my gosh, now what am I going to do now? And you play on that playing field and you dance around that one. At some point in time, you've set up your initial strategy. This is generally in your 20s when this happens. You're generally in your youthful, young adult, extending now into perhaps a little bit greater maturity in your culture, belonging more to your culture, which happens around age 28, 29, 30, and perhaps even into the early 30s, this as your first or one of your significant relationships. You set up a strategy. The two of you kind of tacitly, maybe you don't discuss it, but you kind of intuit it with each other by dancing around and seeing how you can just tick somebody off and get them really upset. Okay, then we don't go that far. We pull back over here and you figure out your boundaries. You figure out what limits you got. And often what happens is that structure, that definition, that pattern will run the rest of the relationship or at least continue it for quite some time. That pattern is inherently limiting and destructive to you, to your light, because it is based upon your shame. Hiding your shame, trying not to feel pain, not feeling safe, not feeling loved, but seeking love. Manipulating yourself or the other, controlling yourself or the other, in order to adjust to it, to make it work. The most pronounced pattern is where one of the partners takes the role of parent and the other one takes the role of the child. The parent can set up rules and set up the authority, and the child will either submit or try to please the child version or do an adolescent rebellion and resistance or some kind of manipulation to even it out. And the two will spar and dance. And sometimes, many times, they'll swap roles, that the parent will go into child at some point and the child position will, that person will move into the parent position. A typical example of that is a man and a woman in a youthful relationship, and the man feels that in order to maintain a sense of virility and masculinity, he has to be the dominant person and set the tone, and this is the way it's got to be, and this is the interests we have, and this is where we do this, and here's where we live, and this is the kind of, you know, interests that we pursue on what we do here, on how we do it, on that kind of thing, and this is what's important. And we work around that, around my preferences and my priorities. That's what's important. It's important that the woman support me. That's what a woman's supposed to do. So we're going to do what men and women are supposed to do. The men are supposed to take charge and make decisions and make the money. And the woman is supposed to do the support and raise the kids and keep the house clean and all that kind of stuff. And then the woman in that situation will try to fit what she thinks is the role she should be playing, because if she doesn't keep the house clean enough, then there's something wrong with her. Or if somehow or another she displeases him, it's her fault. Or she did something wrong, and she feels guilty. And so they play a dance like that. And then every now and then, she thinks, well, my gosh, he's got to take care of this, and he's got to eat right, and he's got to have good clothes, and so forth, and he won't go out shopping, and he's not going to fix his own food, and if I don't fix the food and make him eat this food, he's going to just live on candy bars. I'm just not going to let him do that. I'm going to set up his diet, and I'm going to insist that he do this, and he can't put his clothes there in the living room floor. He's got to put them in the laundry hamper, and I'm going to take charge here. And then she becomes the parent. And then he becomes the whiny child. Then he wants to keep escaping, running out with his buddies, to be carefree and irresponsible, while she at home has to take care of everything and run the store, so to speak. a typical old-fashioned dynamic that your culture fed you. A parent-child dynamic. A parent and a child are not good lovers. In fact, in your culture, you have some laws about that. Parents and children, you understand it's abusive. It's not correct because the child is not at the same level of functioning power as the adult or the grown-up. So you recognize that disparity, and then therefore it is the adult or the grown-up who is abusing the child is taking undue or incorrect actions. So it's recognized that a parent-child dynamic, in actuality, doesn't work. But when it comes to a romantic relationship, or even a relationship with a good friend, or again, business partner, the parent-child dynamic is brought up. But it doesn't work. They're people of two equal power levels, two grown-ups. Parent-child dynamic never works. They can never get into union. They can never get into communion. There's always a disparity. There's always a gap. There's always a lack of safety in that relationship. And it can even go deeper into what is known as a codependent relationship. In fact, it very often just leads directly into that. A codependent relationship will have a dominant partner and a submissive partner or a reactive partner. The dominant partner will set up rules. The dominant partner will be easily offended by certain topics. The dominant partner may be very jealous and possessive. So the submissive or reactive partner has to obey the rules, has to avoid certain topics. Keep the mouth shut. We don't talk about that. Because if we soon as I talk about that, you know, my partner goes ballistic and threatens to leave, threatens to create separation and pain and loneliness. So I can't talk about that. Zip it. Or the submissive or reactive partner will go, well, I'm just going to argue with them and we're going to fight it out. And by golly, if they don't let me do what I want to say and so on, well, I'm going to reject them first. I'm going to run away. I'm just going to get in the car and I'm going to drive and I'm not going to show back up for 2 or 3 days. Let them see how they feel about that. Sometimes a dominating partner will do that if the submissive partner brings up the wrong topic of conversation. The jealous possessive one will insist on keeping track of every activity that the other partner does. Keeps track of the friends, determines who they're allowed to see, what they're allowed to spend, where they're allowed to go. Because the object here is that if I have enough control over my partner who I can force, I can control and make them love me. And if they don't love me, at least they're going to give me all the attention I want. But I'm going to really control them. And I'm afraid that if I let them out of my sight, if I let them out of my control, they might go run off and give attention to other people. And I would be left looking humiliated. I would be left alone. I would be left rejected and abandoned and a failure, a loser. And I can't let that happen. So I've got to control this person. And if I can't have them, nobody can. One of the reasons that so many people thought that O.J. Simpson was guilty was because he said those very words to his wife only weeks before she died. If I can't have you, nobody can. Nobody else can. People said, could that be the act of a very jealously insane husband, ex-husband, that made him suspect because he was holding the codependent point of view. And the codependent point of view, taken to its ugliest extreme, is violence and death. Because the loss of image and the loss of attention and the loss of value is so potentially scary that in order to eliminate that risk, a person can go insane and kill their partner. If it's bad enough, if the shame is deep enough, if it's painful enough, if it's reactive and boiling enough, filled with rage and spite and resentment and fear. The dark, seamy side. And then there's the codependent aspect, in which one partner has a self-destructive kind of habit, like gambling or alcoholism, or is obsessed with, you know, the computer, or sports obsessed, or obsessed with something that takes their attention away from their mate. And is also not helpful for them, like drugs or certain kinds of partying or abusive situations. So the partner thinks that in order to have this relationship work, I've got to fix this person. I've got to help them overcome their problem. I've got to help them stop their food addiction, or help them get them to a doctor or to a therapist. Take them to personal development workshops and things like that. I've got to help them. I'm going to supply them books to read. I'm going to, you know, give them CDs to listen to. Maybe they'll meditate. Maybe they'll get stronger. Maybe they'll take care of themselves. But does it work? No. Because the one who has a self-destructive problem is getting fed too much by the attention that the other person's giving to them. Hey, this works. I get all this attention. Plus, I can go and be irresponsible sometimes. I can let my power go, and I can just let this thing take me on. There's this wonderful hit of power and love that I get when I first smoke that cigarette or that, you know, joint or that drink that drink or eat, pig out on that chocolate or whatever it is. I get that high. I get that hit. That's a hint of love. That's a piece of love. And then my mate gives me all this attention about it. And they care. They worry for me and they care about it. And I feel really, really guilty that I have this problem. But I can't give up the hit. It's too empowering. It's too over-empowering, overpowering. I can't release it. I can't resist it. I crave it. I gotta have it. I want that hit. Even if it doesn't last as long now as it used to, I want that hit really bad. It feels so great for that second, for that moment when I hit that high place and I feel powerful and free and light and... Oh. And then, you know, of course I come back down and so, and then I feel really guilty about it. But then they give me lots of attention and they're so good and so on. I wish I could be better for them. But I need that hit. And I need that attention. And the partner that's trying to do the fixing up, always saying, well, once I get them straightened out, then I can have a life. Then I'll have a great relationship. Then it'll be a wonderful experience. My life will be grand. Any of you have ex-husbands or wives, you might recognize pieces at various degrees of intensity of these patterns we talk about. Then there is factors that come into relationships that people on spiritual path who are more aware tend to notice. These are influences from other lifetimes. You know, I know this person. It feels like I know. I'm so comfortable. I know we've been together. Let's go and get a reading and find out what lifetimes we had together and so forth. And that we're back together because we didn't get to have all our love and finish all up in this other lifetime. So now, this time, we're going to do it right. This time, it's going to be grand. This time, we're going to fulfill our connection. This is kismet. This is the fantastic good stuff this time. Because we have these other lifetimes who are bringing us together. We would suggest, though, since so many people think about other lifetime experiences, they're not really that important. A lot of people are very disappointed because they want some kind of marker that says, this is the person you're supposed to be with. Once again, we're talking generally 20-somethings, sometimes 30-somethings as well. This is the person I want to be with because we've been together before. It just feels right. It's so we have destiny together. Well, past life connections are very difficult to trace. Because when a person asks us about past lives and we go and look at them, they're like these like movie reels that unfold and we can read the movie and we can talk to them about the movie. But it's not really necessary that these are past lives. These could be cultural imprints picked up. In other words, they could be implants. They could think, oh, I had this type of a relationship. I had this type of experience in this other lifetime. And that explains this in this lifetime. But it could be just a cultural imprint that you seem to resonate with. So, hey, you know, that will show up, too, as part of the movie. The movie that we see as a, quote-unquote, past life or other lifetime very often is just the patterns or imprints the person needs to know about and how they play it out in creative illusion. It can still be useful as a feedback tool, but it's not a determinant of whether a relationship is good or not, whether it's destiny and fated or not. That's up to the choice of the two people involved. Another factor that comes into play in relationships has to do with people who are especially on a spiritual path and they come into a relationship. People on a spiritual path, generally the ones who tend to think about these other lifetimes, and they also can come from experiences, social imprints, and lifetimes in which they've taken vows, where they've taken vows to abstain from sex. They've taken vows of celibacy. They've taken vows that they're going to put God first, and they will have no other lovers. So some people who come into their spiritual work end up being very much a single person. And they wonder, why? Why don't I have my soulmate? Or why don't I have this other person from another lifetime? Why don't I have my destiny or fated person? And sometimes that's because there was a vow made that I'm going to do the spiritual stuff, and the spiritual stuff and the relationship stuff will not overlap. So as long as I'm doing my spiritual mission, I'm not going to have relationship. And sometimes this is actually a good thing to a certain extent, because there are some people that if they got a relationship that they thought was this fantastic, wonderful relationship, a soulmate relationship, and we'll discuss that in a minute, this incredible, transcendent, powerful, spiritually designated relationship, that everything would work out really well, there wouldn't be any problems in the relationship, it would turn out ideal, they would be happy forever and ever. Does this sound like a fantasy from adolescence or what? Right? But at the same time, they may have a vow. And it may be that vow was there for a purpose bleeding through into this lifetime. Because sometimes vows are made for the whole spiritual path and not just for a single lifetime. That if they did find that person, they would abandon their spiritual work. They would start working on themselves. They'd pay all their attention to this person. They would fall into a social dynamic that would not be that healing. So if you've ever had any reflection of that or any suggestion of that, you would need to recognize how to be a mature and powerful spiritual adult without letting yourself fall into the trap of total obsession with a mate. The soulmate issue, though, does come up rather often when we talk to people. They want their soulmate. They want that person who will complete them. So they will feel that love, that divine love, here on the planet. Soulmates can be romantic partners, but they can also be parents, grandparents, children, grandchildren, nieces, nephews, business partners, friends, teachers. Soulmates can be anywhere. Soulmates generally are people that you feel an extraordinary resonance with and an instant kind of loving energy. And within the context of that beautiful energy, then you can grow and learn and be and expand who you are in a beautiful way. If you do not lose your own power and your centeredness for that person, you may be able to bring one in. And it's not really a bad thing if you find a really good partner who's not your soulmate. We sometimes give the example of the one who channels us, she and Daniel. They are not soulmates. They have a fabulous relationship. But if they had met soulmates at the same time that they met each other, they would have gone straight far afield focusing on just that. So they found someone to match with themselves. Because their romantic, ultimate romantic soulmate is not going to be in this lifetime. And a lot of people, when they even think about that concept, can say, oh no, I will never find the love I'm looking for if I can't find my soulmate. I need that love. I need that relationship. And we would suggest that soulmates are highly overrated, number one. They're wonderful for a time. And there's some people who can have enough maturity that they can handle being with their soulmate for years and years at a time. And that's wonderful because then they are creating a template, a pattern that other people can see and follow and see as real and possible. But you can theoretically love anyone completely and totally and experience divine union. You don't need a soulmate or somebody specially provided to you from another lifetime to experience it. It's something you create. That's part of what you came here for, is to play in this illusion and to create all the wondrous things as you remembered who you are. As you learn to love, as you learn to create and build a healthy relationship, as you learn to heal and let go of the unhealthy patterns. And those of you, to the extent that you've done that, you can see that whatever relationship you have can be as glorious as a soulmate relationship. You don't need the predetermined stamp of approval on it. You can create it. You can create a phenomenal relationship with a lover, with a friend. And you can also heal relationships with past mates, heal relationship with family members, even those that kind of look down their noses at you like, oh, you're sad and pathetic. You know what that strategy is. That's an adolescent strategy. Please come back. Give up your strange ways and come back and join the fold. You can heal those relationships too. You can come to peace with relationships. You can make any relationship a healing relationship because the key is you. The key is, do you, in your relationship with yourself, love you? One of the places where you begin to heal a relationship is this. You first acknowledge who you are, even if you don't remember. You first acknowledge that you are a divine light being. You're here to have an experience in the illusion, to have some fun, to learn how to create with the illusion and play with it in this glorious playing field called your life and your reality that is beautifully provided for you by you working with the divine energies, specifically organized for you to reflect you, to enable you to regain the knowledge of your divinity. So first of all, claim that. Own that. If you go to the website, galexisspirit.com, you'll see a little quote, a little saying on the very home page. And if you don't have a way of reinforcing your spiritual self, the knowledge of your own divinity, we recommend that you go there and read it every day. Read, let it sink in. Let it absorb into you. Claim it and own it. Who you are, a spark of the divine, a spark of consciousness. You're worthy. You're a beautiful, powerful, divine being. You're a powerful reality creator. This is your playground, your field of play. Own it. And when you do, then you can begin the steps. Or even beginning to own it, you can begin the steps of healing your relationships of the past. And if you have one currently, you can start to heal that. Even if that pattern has been anchored in over years and years of time. It takes two people to maintain a dysfunctional pattern. It takes two people to play the codependent game. It takes two people to play parent-child. If only one person is wanting to play it, but the other person stays resolutely in adult, that game cannot be played. The person who wants to play the game will not be able to do it. They just can't do it. Either they will change and become someone adult and mature and a light being themselves, or they will at least become ineffectual in shaming the other. They will not be able to control, manipulate, dominate, possess, ridicule, shame, reject, humiliate, and abandon the other any longer. They can't do it. If you stop playing the game, nobody can do that to you. They've only done that to you because you've been willing to allow them to do it. When you take your power back as a light being, they cannot do it any longer. They will try, but they cannot. As long as you hold your light. And if you're in between relationships and you're looking for a love relationship, or you're looking for new friends, we would recommend for you to remember, keep your light bright, keep your light strong, stand in your adult self, refuse to go into parent-child or codependent dynamics. Be honest with who you are and be honest as you are. And that'll start breaking old patterns, so that who you attract to yourself will be attracted to this new you, the greater and more expanded light being that you are. And then, of course, the quality that you attract to you will also be more light, more expanded, so that you can attract and draw to yourself relationships, friends, clients, co-workers, lovers, family members even, who are willing to be okay with you, who you can love and perhaps exchange. The love that you get from another is actually your love reflected back to you. It's your reality, every piece of it. Some people say, oh, no, I don't want that. I want the love to be real. It has to be their love, they're loving me. No, your love is the love that's real. So love, start loving yourself, and that's by claiming who you are. And in your loving of yourself, also release and heal the part of you that still plays the child. Heal and release the part of you that still plays the adolescent and all those games. Heal and release the part of you that still buys in to the idealistic thoughts about what life is about that the young adult held. The opinionated young adult you used to be. You let go of these three pieces of yourself. The ones who establish parent-child dynamics and codependent relationships. The ones who yearn for the other lifetime influences. The ones who yearn for the soulmate, which is an adolescent longing. The Romeo and Juliet longing over through the separation, the longing for each other. What is it in Germany? There was the sorrows of young Werther. Now, we bring that up because the one who channels us took German in college. And, of course, they presented all the students with German literature. And there was the sorrows of young Werther. And here was this young man who pined for this woman, the love of his life, from afar. Did he ever go up to her and get to know her? No. He saw her from afar. He put her on this pedestal. He worshipped her. He adored her. He loved her. But he could never be an equal to her. He could never let it happen. So the important thing here is to realize you don't need to play any of those games in the future, and you need to heal those from your past. So once you let go of these three inner personalities, then you can start to envision and dream a healthy, powerful, whole, healing relationship for yourself. And we're going to be doing that later on in the workshop. We will give you a basis of that, details about that. So for now, what we're going to do is we're going to take a break. And during this break, we would suggest that you do what you need to do in a break. It's not going to be very long. After the break, we will have questions. So think about these patterns. Think about where you played games, with whom, what kind of games, what kind of patterns did you play with in your past? Is there any that still remain that you'd like to get rid of or to clear? Any clarification you would like to have? You will have the opportunity to ask that in the next section. But for now, we're going to close, and we'll be back shortly. Farewell.